Good morning.
I'm Kimberly Chronic. Today is Friday, July 7th, 2017, and I'm at the WIL Studios in Urbana with Sergeant Donald Heitch. Welcome. So let's just start. Please tell me in your voice, tell me your name, where you were born, and your birth date.
My name is Donald Jerome Heitch. I was born in Northport, Alabama, but I grew up in Chicago.
And what date?
And my birthday is January 21st, 1951.
And what part of Chicago did you grow up in?
The South Side.
All right. Inglewood?
Yes, the Inglewood District.
What was it like for you growing up in Inglewood in the 50s and 60s?
It was a lot different. It was, by Chicago being a city, you would never think that my exposure to other groups, other like whites and so forth, I didn't have no interaction with them at all. The only time I really seen white people was when I went downtown or we had certain deliveries that came into our area, like the hostess guy, the guy that delivered the liquor, the pop, so forth. Because during that time, I didn't ever see any black drivers, you know, black delivery men. They was mostly white. And, of course, most of the police during that particular era was white. So, you know.
So in your neighborhood, it was an all-black neighborhood?
Mm-hmm.
And the patrol officers were white or black?
They were mostly white. It was a few, very few, you know.
And what were the interaction with the white people that you had when you were growing up? What was that like?
It was, well, I really didn't have that much. And I had a sense of physical superiority for some reason. I don't know why, but I learned that when finally I went to the Marines and got my butt whipped by one. Then I realized that wasn't true.
Okay. Where do you think this came from?
I don't know. I think that, I don't know, maybe the Mandingo thing, a lot of times when they showed us these muscles and, you know what I mean, and all that type of stuff. So I guess I got it from there. Yeah.
And talk about your home life in your all black community and your neighbors and your teachers. What did it feel like to grow up in that? Was it nurturing? Was it comforting?
Yeah, it was. It was very nurturing. It was during that particular era, unlike now, where we didn't have the luxury of standing on the corner smoking marijuana. We couldn't do that. It was that saying that it takes a whole village to raise someone. That's the concept that was going on during that particular period. I'm an only child, but you would think I had 100 grandmamas and granddaddies because wherever I would go in that neighborhood, they knew me. And if they saw me doing something that I shouldn't have been doing, they would tell me. I'm going to tell your mama, I'm going to tell your daddy. Or in some cases, they would beat my butt themselves. You know, so it was kind of like that. And we did a lot of things together, block parties and stuff like that. For us to have a block party, it could be decided and say like everybody, we wake up and it's a Saturday and everybody look, ooh, this is a beautiful day. Let's have a block party. And we just have it. And we didn't ask for permits and all this type of stuff. Everybody just got together. We would go from house to house. What you cooking? And what you gonna cook? And you gonna bring this? And then, you know, and we have it.
Sounds nice.
Yeah.
What about teachers? The teachers live in your name? Tell me about the school.
No, the schools was very real nice. You know, they was. I didn't have no problems. I wasn't a disciplinary case or nothing. Schools was pretty good. You know, I guess all the normal stuff. That you go through in school. Most of my teachers were black. It was a few white teachers there, but most of them was black. You know.
Talk about your immediate family, your mom and your dad. Tell me about them and what they did and your thoughts about them as parents.
Okay, my mother, she worked at a hospital. Let me go back. At first, my mother used to leave me with my grandmother a lot because my father, when we were living in Alabama, she had divorced him and she left and went to New York. So consequently, my grandmother took me to New York a couple of summers. And finally, my mother moved to Chicago. And then once she got settled in Chicago, I came there to stay with her. So during that particular time, a few years later, I ended up with a stepfather. He was real disciplinary, real disciplinary. I wasn't too fond of him at first because I wasn't used to a man telling me what to do. I was just used to my mother telling me or my grandmother. But I don't know, my mother always pushed education and stuff like that. She didn't take no mess and she still don't. You know, as far as me trying to jive her or whatever, you know. I broke her heart when I joined the Marines. She didn't like that at all, you know, because it was a war going on, you know.
Yeah, let's talk about that. What, did you have any relatives in the military?
Yeah, I had cousins and stuff that had went, and that's what made me interested in going to the military because cousins I idolized. You know, they were older than me, and I kind of looked up to them. So when they went, of course, I wanted to go.
And were they cousins in Chicago or Alabama? Or
they were, well, they were, a couple was in Alabama, and some was in Chicago, you know.
And how old were you when you moved to Chicago with your mom?
I had to been like, how old was I? Like 9, 10, somewhere now.
Okay. Yeah. Well, so you joined the Marines. Tell me about your dates of service and in the Marines and when you were in Vietnam.
My date of service, I joined the Marines in April 1969. I enlisted for 4 years. I went to Vietnam in 1970. And I stayed there 13 months.
And tell me why, since you enlisted, why did you pick the Marines?
Because I didn't want to go to the Army. And I was fascinated with the Marine Corps dress blues. And plus, I had a cousin that had went to the Marines. And during that particular era, to be a serviceman was prestige, you know. People looked up to you. You know, you were somebody, you know, and I liked that, you know.
Okay. And so had you thought about further education beyond high school or
not really? No.
Okay. What is it about the Marines, or why not the Army? You said you didn't want to enlist in the Army. What was wrong with you?
No. Army? Well, because first of all, I had two cousins who had already went to the Marines, and like I say, I liked the dress blues. I liked their uniforms, and I liked it. The way they was treated, as opposed to the Army, they seemed to be treated differently. And then the Army was, it seemed like that's where most of all the blacks went, was to the Army, you know. And I wanted to be different, so I went to the Marines.
And you said you enlisted when the Vietnam War was going on.
Yes.
What did you think about the draft, and were you afraid of being drafted?
Yeah, but I didn't think I would go to Vietnam because I don't have any sisters or brothers. But little did I know that don't keep you out of a combat situation. What keeps you out of a combat situation is you got to be the sole survivor to carry on your name. And I have uncles and stuff, you know, so the name would be carried on. I would have to be the last person, you know, to give me that exempt from going to a combat situation, but they don't tell you all of that, you know. And so I went, and lo and behold, I went to Vietnam.
So tell me a little bit. So, but what was your sense of the draft? So you did make a conscious choice for many reasons. What was your sense of the draft, and did you know people who were being drafted and made the choice to enlist rather than being drafted, even though you didn't think you were going to be?
Yeah. Well, during that era, most guys thought they would be drafted. Excuse me. The only way you wouldn't be drafted is for you to get a deferment. And you had to be in medical school or something like that, or, you know, something along those lines. So that never entered my mind about a deferment. I always thought that I would end up in the service. almost everybody I know ended up in the service. And one of them, you know, and most of them ended up in the Army because they got drafted. Most of them got drafted, and they got drafted for 2 years. I stayed in the Marine Corps 4 years because it's an actual contract that you sign when you go into service. So you kind of like trying to sell yourself. You're bargaining with them. And they wanted me to give them 4 years. And I kept saying, no, I want to go for 2 years. And they kept saying, no, you got to give us four. So eventually I went for the four.
And you said your mom was, well, you said pissed that you enlisted.
Yeah.
Did she think you weren't going to get drafted? Or why was she angry if so many people were having to?
Well, she was angry because we had known a bunch of people that they either came back from Vietnam, something was wrong with them, or a lot of them didn't come back. You know, it was nothing. Everybody during that era knew somebody that died over there. You know, that was common. You know, so of course, me being 18, I didn't think of death and stuff like that. I didn't see myself going nowhere dying. But her being my mother, being a more mature person, you know, she understood that. Yeah, and she was really pissed about that.
And what was it? You were, this civil rights movement was, there were a lot of struggles and victories and everyone, the civil rights movement was very much alive and mobilized.
Yes.
How did that impact your sense of self or your service in the military? Did it in any way?
Well, eventually it did. Initially it didn't. Because I didn't see that. I didn't realize that the service was somewhat segregated. I didn't know anything about that. That was one of them things that wasn't talked about a lot. But when I went to the Marine Corps, I realized the Marine Corps was an expression we used back in that day was virtually lily white. You know, most of the guys in the Marine Corps, if you look at old pictures and stuff, you don't see hardly no blacks, you know. And mostly all blacks went to the infantry, you know, during that particular time. Very few went to technical jobs, technical skills and stuff. Most white guys got those jobs, you know.
Talk a little bit about that. What you observed, how some of the differences in ways you and other black Marines were treated, what you saw, whether it was boot camp. Let's start with boot camp, yeah, because we're...
Boot camp was, that's where I was. I mean, the drill instructors during that era could put their hands on you, you know. They would beat your butt, period, and they would call you the N-word and anything else they wanted to call you, and you couldn't do nothing about it, you know. It was kind of like an accepted thing. Racism was all through the military, you know, during that particular era. And it wasn't, we had racial scrimmages in Vietnam where we would go to the enlisted man club and get to fighting and stuff like that. And, you know, and the Viet Cong was slick. What they would do was if a patrol went out and say, like, if it was 3-4 blacks in the patrol and it was 7 whites, they would kill as many of the whites as they could and not mess with none of the blacks. So consequently, when they go back to their unit or whatever, it created, why none of them didn't get, you know, even though if it wasn't talked about, you thought it.
And what did you understand the reason was that blacks weren't shot at by the Viet Cong, but the white?
Propaganda. The Vietnamese, the Viet Cong was aware of the struggles in the United States. You had to think, we were so isolated over there in Vietnam. The stuff that was going on in the United States, we didn't know nothing about it. The only way we knew about it is somebody sent us a newspaper clipping, or most of the time the Viet Cong would let us know, either in some type of leaflet or, you know, there were incidents where a loudspeaker would just be, you know, they would just speak over loudspeaker about what was going on. back in the United States. And they would say stuff like, black man, it's not your war. Why don't you go home? Don't you know in Detroit, this is going on. Or in Chicago, this going on. Yeah.
Were there other black Marines in your unit when you served?
Yeah. It was but most of the blacks, when I went to the air wing, it wasn't really. In the infantry, it was plenty blacks. But in the air wing, it wasn't a lot of them there. It wasn't a lot of crew chiefs or the guys that worked on the jets or the helicopters. It just wasn't a lot of blacks into that. You know, and there were times when we would have racial situations over there when I would go down to the infantry. You know, the infantry, where they stayed, was like maybe two or three blocks from where I was at. So I would go down there and stay down there with them because, I don't know, you go to the club or something and you with all these white guys and we all right and cool, and then we go to the club and something happens there and it be racial, and you just felt funny going back with all of them, and you know that these black guys just beat them up or whatever, you know. And sometimes it would be the other way around, you know, where they would beat up the black guys. So it was just a bad situation. And those situations were stuff that's never been talked about. They just don't talk about that.
Do you have any specific memory of any, I've gotten a good picture. Mm. Do you remember one particular incident that you could share with us?
Well, there were many, just at the Enlisted Man Club, because we had them. And of course we could drink. And once we get to drinking and stuff, you know, we get into it. To be honest with you, I can't remember just one specific. It was a lot of them. It was, you know, most of the time, that wasn't in nobody died. Not that I'm aware of, but there were times that people got messed up pretty bad, you know.
And did that, you know, you hear a lot about, you know, the military, you're a cohesive, tight unit, you're going to protect your person's back, they're going to get yours.
Mm-hmm.
Despite these racial fights and name calling, when you were actually in the combat zone, was it different, or did you notice the racial tension?
It was different. Because you had to depend on each other. You know, you didn't have that luxury of not liking the guy next to you. You know, you just didn't have that luxury. Most guys in units, some guys say, like, in a unit, the blacks and the whites were real tight. And say, like, another unit, they wasn't like that. You know what I'm saying? And this particular unit, the one where they real tight at, they would stick together no matter what they dealt with. The reason for that is because they had to depend on each other. When they went into the bush and stuff, you had to depend on that guy that was behind you. You know, plus the fact you wouldn't want to be out there and someone could just blow your brains out, and you won't even know it. It ain't like they was running around in Vietnam having ballistic check. You know, you don't know, they don't know how you died. I mean, they don't know who shot you. They're assuming that it was the enemy. But, I mean, if you had situations where somebody hated you or didn't like you or something, that, you know, they could do that. So you tried to stay away from that.
Did you feel when you were, and we'll get into your specific service in a moment, but in general, did you trust the white Marines that you were on the helicopter with,
yeah,
or on the ground with?
Yeah, I did, yeah. Mm-hmm. I had to, and they had to trust me. It's particularly the pilots. You know, the pilots don't have a rearview mirror. The helicopter don't have that, you know. It's so loud that you can't see. You can't hear when you're being shot at. Yeah.
I want to know a little bit about your basic training, if you would. Mm-hmm. Where were you? Where did you train? And talk a little bit about that.
MCRD San Diego. when I went there, I was really fascinated by the fact that I could do things that I thought I never would be able to do, because they pushed you to the brink. But also what they did was they brainwashed you. And the way they brainwashed you was every time they would tell us, they had a command where they would say, at ease. When they say at ease, we would say kill, you know. And then when we finally sit, we would say Viet Cong, you know. So, and this went on during your whole training cycle. So by the time you got to Vietnam, you was ready to shoot anything looked Vietnamese, because you was brainwashed, you know.
And did you realize it at the time?
No, not at all. And we had, they call it ITR, and I don't forget what that acronym, but anyway, they had the huts and stuff set up. It looked just like Vietnam, you know, on Camp Pendleton. And we would go there over and over and over again. We would assault that village, you know, over and over and over again, never thinking that it's possibly women, children, and all that in this village. Your mind was kind of like, ain't nothing there but some males trying to kill you, you know. You, no one said, wait a minute, it could be some kids there or stuff like that. They didn't, you know, that never was talked about. What was talked about was, this is the Vietnamese village. You're going to run into this when you get there, and the enemy going to be in there. So when you get there, you're on automatic, you know.
And that's what they trained you to do.
That's what they trained you to do.
And what, do you remember when you got your Westpac papers, the day that you got those and what those are?
Yeah. When I got them, I didn't know what Westpac meant. You know, and Westpac don't say Vietnam, it say Westpac, whatever that meant. And, I remember getting them, and we was talking about it, and finally I realized that's what it meant. But you don't go that particular day. You still do whatever you're doing. And one day they would say, like, we finna have this drill or whatever. And you get all your equipment and stuff together, and then you run out to this bus. First of all, they have this drill 3 or 4 times before you actually get on a plane. You know, they have you to get on buses or trucks, and they would drive you to an airport or someplace that, you know, where they had a plane, and you would get there and you would act like you finna run up on the plane and they finna deploy you someplace. But then they would say it's a drill. So consequently, you get back on the vehicles and you go back. Now, one particular time, they called that and we got on the plane. And when the plane landed, it landed in Okinawa, Japan. And we stayed in Japan about 6 days, and after that, we went to Vietnam. Yeah.
And do you remember the flight to Japan or to Vietnam?
Yeah. It was the man, it was about 18 hours. Believe me, the world is two-thirds water, because all of that time, that's all I saw was water. Every now and then, you would see a rock, an island or something. But most of it was just water, you know.
Do you remember how you felt when you were finally going, what your thoughts were, what your emotions were?
Excitement, fear, all of that. You know, because I was a Marine, you know, and I had admired the guys that had been and came back, and they had all the rolls of ribbons and medals and stuff, you know, and I wanted that, you know, and the only way you can get it is to do that. And then my focus was not on the ones that didn't come back, but on the ones that did. Because one thing about the military, now that I think about it, the base itself, you didn't see cripples or people with no arms, no legs, or because they went to Vietnam. The people you saw were people that was healthy. They may have been wounded or whatever in Vietnam, but they were all right now. So you didn't get that sense of something would happen to you like that. Or if it did, you still had a sense that probably you would survive. You know, now if I had went to a VA hospital, prior to that, I would have had a whole different, another take on that. You know, because that's where you see the guys that no legs. And as a matter of fact, if you notice now, on television, you see more ads, commercials and stuff about veterans, and they show them with no legs, no arms, no this and that. Think about it. You didn't see that. You just did not see it. But now you see it all the time.
So tell me about, what was your assignment in Vietnam? What was your job title? What did you do?
At first, when I got to Vietnam, they sent me to MAG 16, Marble Mountain, and I was in a company called Zulu Company, MAG 16. And basically, our job was the security of the base, because the base was part of the 1st Marine Air Wing, which they had helicopters and all that stuff there. They gave me orders to go and be active in the air wing in terms of being an area door gunner after I was there for a while. And prior to that, I very seldom went out in the bush or anything like that because, like I say, we was basic security for the base. But after that, then we went. When I got on the helicopter, I always saw different stuff. First, they started me out with being familiar with the guns and stuff on the helicopter. And we would go out around there. I think it was the Red China Sea, whatever they call that. Anyway, we would go out there and get familiar with the guns and shoot at fish that we could see swimming or whatever. After that short period, then, you know, I would actually start doing missions. And the missions I started out doing was like resupply. Infantry that's in the bush and stuff, you know, of course they got to get food and they got to have a whole lot of different things. And so that's my job at first. That's what I did. And then slowly it turned to medevac. And medevac is usually part of the dangerous ones because sometimes when you're going to bring out a wounded person, they actually are engaged with the enemy at that particular time. You know, and we don't wait until it's over with. You know, we have to get that person out of there because we're trying to save his life. And at first, that was super scary for me because I thought about it. I thought about what we actually was going to do. After a while, I put it out of my mind. I stopped thinking about it because fear, I was so afraid initially that I didn't tell you this before, but I can remember one of our first missions where I went and we actually was engaged in combat, where I was afraid to shoot the weapon. I was stuck. You know, I was so afraid. And I could see the traces and stuff coming up from the ground. I could see the flashes. So I know we was being shot at. But I just could not pull the trigger. I was stuck, you know. The other gunner on the helicopter, because it's two guns. The gun stick out the right and the gun stick out the left. And basically what they do is what they call a spiral. And the reason they do that is so we cover a 360-degree thing, and it comes down like this, like in a circle. I call it like a bed spring. It comes down like that so that a gun is constantly, you know, being turned. Because the only way we can stop the enemy from shooting at us is we maintain fire superiority. And fire superiority means I must suppress your fire. And the way I suppress your fire is I got a machine gun, I can shoot faster than you, and I got the high ground, you know, and I got seeming like unlimited amount of rounds because I'm on a helicopter and I'm not carrying in these bullets. My bullets are in a big old box. So when we engage the enemy, I'm constantly shooting because I can't allow him to shoot up at me. So during this time when I froze, you see how dangerous that was? And holes started appearing in the helicopter everywhere. It's just lucky we didn't get, nobody got shot or anything. But the pilots and stuff went off on me. You know, the other guys on the helicopter, yeah, they was pretty pissed. They said, if you can't do this, then you can't do this.
And then you were able to do it.
Yeah. What I did was I went from one end of the spectrum to the other end. I just became a damn fool. And what I mean by that was I didn't care. I would do stuff that people would say was heroic, but they wasn't heroic. It was fear. I was afraid, and that's the way I dealt with my fear. You don't know people that you probably grew up with, and they were people that looked like they fight anybody and all that type of stuff, but actually they are scared people, you know, and that's fear that's causing them to act the way they act, you know, and basically that's how I was operating.
And just to clarify, so you were an area door gunner.
Area, yeah.
Area door gunner, and you had an M16 machine gun?
No, M60.
M60, pardon me. And can you give me an example of something you did out of fear that was foolish, but that you were compelled to do?
Oh, like went down on a jungle penetrator. A jungle penetrator is a big old lead ball that has legs on it. And the guy that we was going to medevac wasn't able to get on that, and we couldn't land. It was just too dense. So I got on this jungle penetrator, and they lowered me down. And the only way that they knew where to go was by a strobe light, a little light that flashes like this. You know, because in Vietnam, you got to think, you can't see your hands in front of your face. You know, but one of the things, and I have to say this, it's the most beautiful sky you ever seen. You'd be amazed at all the stars that are in the sky. That pollution, we don't see it, but over there you see all of that. But anyway, I went down on this jungle penetrator, and I get the guy, and I strap him to me, and then we get pulled back up, you know. And that was... When I was first told to do that, my initial thing was, are you for real? But then once again, I allowed fear to take over. And I said, yeah, I'll do that. Come on, man, let's go get him, you know.
So you went from being on the helicopter and giving supplies to the troops to bringing wounded soldiers up to firing on the Viet Cong to protect our troops.
Oh, yeah. It was kind of like the process is, I'm not trying to make it like it was steps that you go to, because actually it wasn't. What it was, it just happened to be, that's what was called for at that particular time. Vietnam had a weather condition that was just something else. It could be bright and sunny, and 10 minutes later, everything is soaking wet. Then an hour later, everything is bone dry again, you know. And they had a lot of situations where we would have low clouds, and we couldn't fly, or we couldn't resupply troops and different stuff like that. So some of these times, maybe these troops hadn't been supplied in a couple of days because of the weather, you know. But when we could fly, we immediately did that. That's what I meant when I said that I started out like that, because that's what was going on. But say, for instance, if it was medevacs at that time, I would have did that too, you know.
And when you grabbed that first soldier, was the soldier wounded? And what do you remember about?
Yeah, he was wounded. He had, he was almost, his stomach, his intestines and all that stuff, they had on him what's called like a battle dressing. It's a big old pad that they put on you and they tie around you, and you keep it moist to hold your intestines and all that in, because his was coming out. So when we got him on the helicopter, we pour water on it because we got to keep it moist. You know, you got to keep his organs moist and stuff. The guy didn't feel no pain or anything like that. He asked for a cigarette because they had gave him morphine. You know, he didn't feel no pain.
And what about you? What was the impact on you? to see this, and you repeatedly did this. Is that correct?
Yeah. Well, it was, like I say, I never gave myself time to think about it. I didn't process that like that. I learned how to suppress, though. And I became real good at it because a lot of guys I was in Vietnam with, I couldn't tell you their name. I do not know their names. I don't, very few faces I even remember because I suppressed all of that. I suppressed incidents, you know, various missions, and people I interacted with. I suppressed all of that because we're sitting here, me and you all tight and we cool, and you may be gone tomorrow. And then what am I gonna do then? Now I'm all messed up because you was part of my existence here. Now you're not here no more. You see? So you learn how to protect yourself and stuff like that. Although you was real tight, particularly with blacks. You know, if you seen another black and they could be in the Army and in the Marines, we would stop and greet each other. You know, we had that camaraderie there. But like I said, a lot of that stuff was fear. You know, I learned that much later that's what it was. It was fear, afraid, scared to death. Believe me.
You're talking about, you know, the fear and not being able to shoot that first time. Tell me the story that you told me about that scared soldier you dropped off. Do you remember that?
Oh, the one that didn't want to get off the helicopter?
Yeah, tell me that.
Yeah, well, the thing about that is when we go down into LZ, which is a landing zone, we actually only supposed to be on the ground seconds, not minutes, seconds. And when we were down in this particular LZ and we was taking fire, and this guy didn't want to get off, you know, but he got to get off. We can't take you back with us. You have to get off. So all of his squad and stuff ran off the helicopter, and he still was sitting there, wouldn't get off. So I had to virtually pull my .45 and go back there and almost beat him off the helicopter. And the helicopter was lifting up off the ground, and basically I just pushed him out of it, you know, because I can't take you back. You know, we don't do that.
Do you remember what he looked like?
Yeah, he was a white guy, and I never forget he had these big old giant blue eyes. And that's what I remember seeing, that as he was looking at me, when I saw all that fear in his face. You know, he was scared. He was scared. He was red. He was scared, you know.
Do you tell me this? You also saw a soldier that was being pursued by a Viet Cong, and from the helicopter they were shooting.
Yeah,
tell me
yeah,
that story.
Yeah, well, we seen. I seen a guy that I don't know how he did it, how he survived, because we had went down in this LZ and we was extracting troops, and this one particular guy. How it happened, I don't know, but the Viet Cong, they were chasing him, and we could see that, and he was running, and he would get in this real dense places, like with trees and shrubbery and all that stuff, and you wouldn't see him, but you seen all these Viet Cong, and you said, oh, man, they done got him, and then you look down there again, lo and behold, there he is again, running another way. You know, and this guy was just something else. He made up his mind, I'm not dying today. And he didn't, and we went and got him. But it was something else. And we was up there cheering for him. We wanted him to go to an area where we could hurry up and sit down and pick him up. But he kept staying. He had to stay in the dense areas to avoid him. Because he didn't want to go into no clear area because he knew he would be a target, you know, and he was trying to evade them. And eventually he did. And it was just something else to see that. Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it is.
You guys were happy that day.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We was cheering them on and everything. Everybody. Yeah.
What are some of the sights, the sounds, and the smells that you remember about Vietnam?
Vietnam is real hot, super hot, but burnt bodies is a smell that you, and decaying bodies and stuff like that, you know, you, that never leaves you. You would never forget that smell, you know, and unlike TV where, you know, they can show you combat situations, but they can't give you the details of the sense of the environment and how it felt. And that played a big role a lot of times. And like I said, it could start raining and you sink in the ground because it rains that hard. And then, like I say, a couple of hours later, the ground is just as dry as it can be. It's amazing. But people don't understand. It's a tropical climate. Everything over there, pears was this big. You know, fruits and stuff, everything was big. And, of course, we had a lot of wildlife over there. We had snakes over there that looked like little logs, all that stuff. You know, we had a lot. Vietnam is something else. But it's one of the most beautiful countries you've ever seen.
Have you been back since your service?
No. Do I want to go back? No.
Why not?
I just don't. It's just, I don't know what it'll make me remember. And I know from being in post-traumatic stress disorder classes and stuff I've had and talking to psychiatrists, it's a lot of stuff I don't remember, and I like to leave it that way. Yeah.
You talked about things you saw from the helicopter and the shooting that you had to do, and but you told me before that there's a sort of a distance between the killing and your emotions because you were in the air. Can you talk about
right.
that?
Well, one of the things is, to me, it's nothing to shoot someone. You got to think about it because you got a weapon, and when you fire it, everything goes away from you. The impact of the round and all of that hit the person or whatever, unless you're very close up on him, you don't see none of that. You don't experience his pain. You don't experience, you know, the aftermath of the blood and all that. You don't deal with none of that, you see, because your main objective is to stop him from doing whatever he's doing, trying to hurt you. And once you done accomplished that, you don't be, I wonder why I shot him at. I wonder, is he bleeding a lot? I wonder, is he in pain? I wonder, you don't deal with none of them. You know, you just do not be emotionally attached to any of that at all. You just don't. That's why I can understand these kids in Champaign, the way they're shooting and stuff like that. Because you got to think, if we sitting in the studio, if a guy came in here and started shooting and stuff, he don't experience what that bullet is doing to us. You know what I mean? Because everything goes away from him. Now, that's a lot different when you got to get up on somebody. Now, that's a whole different person.
Were you in that situation in Vietnam?
Where I had to get up on somebody?
Yeah.
No, not really. I did see, I mean, I've been not real close where I could touch you, but I've been pretty close at different times where I could see them, you know, and then, like I say, I start firing and, you know, I don't see you no more, you know, and then the infantry would radio us and tell us about the blood trails they would see because a lot of times you didn't see a body. You just seen a blood trail. You know that whatever it was, that you know that the person you hit, but they always try to pick up their wounded. You know, although sometimes they couldn't, but most of the time they would. They would pick up their wounded. So all you would see is a blood trail, you know.
Tell me, there was a time, though, that you were on the ground and somebody in your unit was a bomb fell. Can you talk
about you mean like incinerated? Yeah, 122 rocket hit a guy, and it hit him point blank. I mean, it hit him, and when it hit him, it disintegrated him. Pieces of flesh, bone, and all that was just everywhere. It was all over me and all that type of stuff, and I couldn't hear for I don't know how long because it was so loud, and it messed up my vision. I didn't tell you that before. It messed up my vision because that flash and that loud sound, as close as I was to it, it just messed up my vision and stuff. I just seen little black spots for, I don't know, maybe like a week. And I didn't fly none of that week because I couldn't hardly see good. And I certainly couldn't hear. I had a ringing in my ear for I don't know how long.
But then your vision and hearing came back to normal?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about your relationship to the Vietnamese. Before you went over there, had you ever thought about Vietnamese people or soldiers?
Not at all. Not at all. Didn't even know they existed. Mm-hmm. Never thought of them at all. And what really blew my mind was when we did get there, we had Vietnamese that actually worked on the base. They would clean up, and some even worked in the barbershop and all that kind of stuff. And then at night, when they were trying to breach our perimeter or whatever, some of those same people that worked on the base would be in the wire dead. Some of those same ones. But during the day, they just smiling in your face and, you know, and all of that. And you might know their name or whatever, you know. Yeah, and at night they're trying to kill you.
So did you have any particular names you would refer to the Vietnamese as, whether they worked on the base or they were in the military?
Yeah, we used to call them gooks. And I, if I'm not mistaken, gook basically means foreign. Now, we really were the gooks, but we called them gooks, you know.
What role did alcohol and drugs play during your time in Vietnam?
Oh, I mean, we stayed drunk and high all the time. A can of beer was 15 cents, you know, and you basically, the rules was very relaxed. I mean, we drank all the time. That was like giving a guy a soda, you know. We stayed drunk, and we stayed, they had some pills over there. I think they were White Crosses. We used to call them BT, and basically it's speed. And what it does is it keeps you woke. It keeps you alert, at least that's the way you feel. Because, say, for instance, I'm on flight status, and I've been on flight status the last 13 hours, just back and forth, you know. In order for me to continue to perform at the level I need to perform at, I would take a BT, and, you know, and that would, it was speed. So I wouldn't get drowsy, I wouldn't be sleepy, and I would feel like I'm still alert. And then after I get back to the rear and it's time for me to go to sleep or whatever, or I try to go to sleep or whatever, I would take something, it'd either be heroin or I would try to drink it down or something to put me now the opposite on the opposite end, you know. So it was a, you know, this wasn't like a everyday thing, but it happened a lot.
And were the sergeants also engaged in this and the pilots?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I used to go get my pilots marijuana and beef, and yeah, because my pilots was officers, and so they didn't want to be in the villages and stuff like that, but I would go in the villages. And that's where you found all your stuff at, you know, in the village. They sold marijuana that looks like Pall Mall cigarettes without a filter. They was called a 10-pack, and they cost 50 cents. And it was 10 of those in a little cellophane package, already rolled up and all of that, and they looked like a Pall Mall cigarette. And all of us that's in the studio couldn't smoke one of them. All of us. We used to play King of the Bunker, and we'd be passing it around. because the marijuana over there was like liquor. You would pass out if you continue. The marijuana today, people smoke it, and after they smoke it a while, then they immune to it. Over there, that marijuana, now, I don't know what it was about it, but believe me, you couldn't continue to smoke it. You would pass out because it was so strong. Yeah.
And were there doctors over there? I mean, yeah, well, what was the relationship to the drugs and alcohol and doctors and the servicemen?
Well, there wasn't no drug programs when I was in the service, I'm aware of. If you became addicted to something or something like that, you had to go see a psychiatrist. You know, that's how they dealt with alcoholism, if they dealt with it at all. I know that I used to be in charge of some guys that basically spoke to, in the mornings, they form a line and we go pick up all the cigarette butts. Anything that God didn't put on the ground, we had to pick up. So a lot of times when they would be in formation, I would walk through the formation. Most of the guys there, I could smell that they've been drinking or this or that. But that was an accepted thing. You know?
What role did prostitution play in Vietnam?
Oh, a big role. They had places in Vietnam we could go that were prostitutes was readily available. I mean, they were everywhere. Everywhere. I mean, sometimes I remember we used to have perimeter duty. We used to go get a prostitute and bring it inside the base at night and have her inside the bunker with us all night. You know, and the next morning we take her back out.
And who was the prostitute? Who were these women?
They were local women, Vietnamese. You know, and I didn't know it, but during that particular time, they were quite young, but you didn't know that at that time because it's hard to assess their age because they all look, you know, they have to, yeah, of course you can tell the mama sign or the papa sign because, you know, their skin start to wrinkle or whatever. But a Vietnamese woman that from the age probably of 15 to 25 or something like that, you can hardly tell the difference. You know, you wouldn't know, because they don't age quick like that, you know.
And you talked about seeing some of the faces of the soldiers who were scared. What were the prostitutes, how were they treated by the men? What was did you have a sense of what they were feeling or did you have anything like that?
No, it was very mechanical. The actual sexual experience, for them it seemed very mechanical. And believe it or not, the prostitution was segregated. We didn't deal with the same prostitutes that whites dealt with. And whites didn't deal with the same prostitutes we deal with, particularly in Okinawa, Japan. You couldn't go. We had our own area in Okinawa, and whites had their area where they went. It's amazing,
that.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
And it was accepted. That was the way it was.
So were these women paid by the soldiers?
Yeah, we paid them. Yeah, we paid them. Maybe like $5 or something like that. Yeah.
And so did you just kind of discover that there's a segregation among the prostitution?
Well, it's kind of like when you get there, of course, there's guys that's been there, you know, and they let you know. You know, they tell you, hey, man, we over here. We go here.
What's an Article 15?
Article 15 is a disciplinary article that they can apply to you. It's kind of like a misdemeanor when they give you an Article 15. What comes after Article 15, I think, is a summary court-martial. A summary court-martial is like a mild felony. And then they got a general court-martial. That's like a Class X. You know, that's the worst you could get, you know.
And did you have an Article 15?
Yeah, I had Article 15. I don't know, nobody probably went to the service, didn't have Article 15. You have Article 15 for almost anything.
And what was the reason for your Article 15?
Not going back when I'm supposed to, you know, stuff like that. Most of it was that kind of stuff.
Do you want to talk about the impact of the prostitution on your health, or is that something you could share?
Yeah, well, most of the time you would end up with a gonorrhea, and, you know, of course you had Cormans over there and stuff, and you could not go to the doctor, because if you know a Corman, you just go to him and he gives you some penicillin. You know, and everybody know you just take so much of it, like I think 1,000 milligrams or something like that, and it clears up. It was par for the course. That was part of it. You almost knew, because you got to think, they didn't have condoms in Vietnam. They didn't have that. Another thing they didn't have in Vietnam is rolling paper. That's why you ever heard the expression shotgun. With marijuana, when somebody say, I'm going to give you a shotgun, because actually, we would stuff marijuana in one end of the barrel of the shotgun, and we would light it, and we would blow it in your mouth or whatever. That's why it was called a shotgun.
Did you know any guys who had children with, because of either relationship?
Oh, yeah. You could tell. A lot of times you wouldn't know if that was your kid or whatever. You just seen a bunch of kids running around now. A Vietnamese got blue eyes. Or a Vietnamese has got a more like a olive complexion and curly hair. You know, you knew that was some black guy, and the one with the blue eyes was probably some white guy. Because I don't think that they had any birth control. You know, and they did have a thing that I mentioned to you, because I never ran into it. A thing where they would take a bamboo stick, and it's hollow. And inside of it, they would put little pieces of razor blade. And a prostitute would insert that in her. And so when a soldier, Marine, or Navy, whatever, went to have sex with them and insert themselves, they would cut their penis. Now, I heard about that a lot. I never ran into it, but I heard about it. There was some women I heard about that had syphilis, you know. But we kind of thought the military was telling us that as a deterrent, so maybe we wouldn't go mess with them, you know, because I never knew nobody had syphilis. They did have some over there that they call it black syphilis, that they say they couldn't cure. They didn't have a cure for it, and they would put you on a ship because you couldn't come back to the United States. You know, because certain diseases you get, you can't re-enter the United States with them. So they put you on a ship, and you just stay on this ship until they figure out what they're doing or you die. Now, all of this was stuff I heard. Now, whether it's all true, I kind of believe it's true, and the reason I believe it's true was because there were guys that was missing and stuff, and they wasn't shot up or nothing. They you just didn't see them no more, and they didn't rotate out of country or anything like that. So, you know, strange stuff.
Yes. Do you remember when you got word that you were going to be going home?
Do I remember that? Yeah, because you already knew your rotation date. You knew that. When you first go there, you know that this is from this date to that date. And when you start getting close to that date, it's when fear really comes in. Man. Because a lot of guys then got killed and had a week, had 3 days left, and all that type of stuff. And you want to go to your CO and tell him, look, I ain't got but a week. Can I stay back here and do such and such and such? And a lot of cases, they won't allow you to do that. You had to still go out there, just like the guy that just came, you know. So, yeah, I mean, during that period, you really become afraid, you know.
And so did you have to keep going out until that
last
day?
Yeah, you had to keep going. Yeah, you might get the last 3 or 4 days, you know, or something like that. In some cases, guys went out up until the day they left. You know, it depended on what you were doing and what was your job, you know.
Do you remember your flight home from country?
Yeah, I remember it. What I remember more than the flight is when we landed in San Francisco and all these demonstrators was calling us baby killers and all that kind of stuff. You know, and how the military basically was telling us, don't wear your uniform, you know, because there was a lot of demonstrators and stuff that was trying to harm us, you know, in different ways. So it was something else. This was along the period in time where they had all these protests and stuff about the Vietnam War and all of that. When I left the United States, I was a hero before I even went. I could be walking down the street and have my uniform on, and a cab would just stop and say, "Hey, Marine, where you going? Come on, get in," and wouldn't charge me anything. I came back, and it was a whole different ball game a year and a month later. Everything changed. The war was so unpopular, you know. That's why I think they got this big push now for, you see all these commercials on TV about veterans and the military and this and that. Because think about it. I mean, you old enough, we don't remember all of that. You know, my grandkids, when I were their age, you know, I've never seen stuff on television about the military like that and stuff. Never saw that.
When you came back, then, did you wear your uniform in the airport, or did you take their advice and not wear it?
No, I didn't wear it. I didn't wear it. I didn't want to. I ain't never seen it. It was a whole bunch of people, and they were trying to hold them back and all that stuff. And some guys didn't have nothing to change in. You got to think, you in Vietnam today and tomorrow, now you back in civilization, the United States. Your mind and everything is still in Vietnam. It takes a while before all of that crossed that water. You know, even though you physically came over here on that plane, but you're still, in a sense, in Vietnam, you know.
Do you remember who you first saw when you came back that was your family or a friend?
Oh, I seen my mother.
She went to pick you up?
No, she didn't even know I was, because I didn't know where I was going to land at or anything like that. And she was living in Inglewood, California. And so the plane landed in San Francisco. And then I went and called another flight down to Los Angeles. And then I called up someone I think I called my uncle or something. He came to the airport and picked me up.
When did you first start to realize, what were the costs to Vietnam on your psyche and your body that you realized later on?
Well, it's a lot of stuff. I came back an addict, an alcoholic. You have a lot of problems that you don't want to be a crybaby about. And you don't relate them to your Vietnam experience. You just don't. And because you be thinking that it's goo gobs of guys didn't come back. It's a whole lot of guys that ain't got legs, arms, can't see anymore and all of that. And here I am, healthy and all of this. Or I felt like that anyway. And I'm not finna go to the VA and be crying about the fact that I seem to can't get along with nobody, you know, or I'm having these dreams, these nightmares and stuff that keep waking me up. And the bed is soaking wet because I'm experiencing stuff in my subconscious that I suppressed, you know. Later on, I learned that's what that is. But I even had to tell my wife, say, certain times when you hear me moaning or something in my sleep, touch me, wake me up, because I'm in a dream, man. I know I am. And because I get real loud and stuff, because in my mind, I'm living that again. You know, and it'd be a lot of stuff I forgot about. I don't even remember, you know. And it just, it blows my mind some of the stuff that I did and stuff that I just don't remember. I just don't.
So how did you cope when you came back? And
drinking and drugging. That's how you cope. That's how I coped. Hard to keep jobs and stuff. A lot of different stuff because you're not owning up to the fact you got problems. You're just not owning up to that.
Did you find any solace with other veterans that came back with you or who were here? Did you reach out to them?
Well, no, I didn't until much, much later. I mean, like 40-some years later. I went to the first time I went to the Danville VA, I was telling them that, yeah, I'm strung out on drugs and this and that. And they had already diagnosed me with post-traumatic stress disorder, but they wouldn't treat the post-traumatic stress disorder until they dealt with the substance abuse problem. Now, I think in 2009 or something, they finally said, no, we're doing it wrong. We need to deal with these at the same time. And when they started doing that, it's when a lot of veterans got breakthroughs then. Because you knew in your heart and your mind that part of your biggest problem was dealing with this stuff you didn't have names for. You didn't know what it was, you know. The alcoholism and all of that stuff, you felt like, if I can deal with this, I can probably deal with that, you know. And so finally, they started dealing with it all together. And that's when I started getting help at that particular point.
So that was in
About 2009.
And what? Tell me about meeting your wife and how your Vietnam experience impacted that relationship or...
Well, she had to be real special in the sense that some of the stuff that I took her through in terms of... most veterans get divorces. Most veterans have been married a couple of times and stuff like that. It's hard for them to keep relationships and stuff. My wife was an exception to the rule because she obviously made up in her mind that regardless of what's going on, I'm going to stick it out. And she kept trying to find ways to help me cope with different things. Her and a friend of hers took me to Danville. Sometimes I had to go to Danville 2-3 times a week. Her and this friend went every time I went. They went with me and took me, you know, and they made sure I didn't miss no appointments and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, they did that. And that takes somebody special because most people feel like you did that to yourself, you know, because they looking at the symptoms of your problem and not how your problem developed. You know, it's easy to say, you're an addict, you know, or you're an alcoholic, but how did I become this? You know, prior to Vietnam, I had never been in trouble in my life. You know what I mean? Didn't have nothing. You know, my biggest thing maybe was a cigarette. I didn't even smoke marijuana before I went to Vietnam. You know, and I certainly didn't have no drinking habit because my mom and them didn't play that. So then none of that stuff exists. But when I first got in the military, I mean... I was 18, and I felt like I could go in a club, and the club is on base, and set up at the bar and say, yeah, give me a couple of beers. You know, they didn't sell hard liquor, but, I mean, let's face the fact. If you drink enough beer, it's like drinking a fifth of Jack Daniels, you know. So we would sit there, and we'd drink pitcher and pitcher after beer and get drunk, you know. It became a way of life. You know, when we got everywhere we went, that's what we did. Every country we went in, that's what we did. Drank. That's what we would do.
What did you, What did you, when you look back almost 50 years, do you, are there things you've learned about yourself? And if so, what did you, when you think about that 18-year-old who enlisted, and now, you know, you're
saying, I learned that I'm more of a survivor than I realize. I realize that I have strengths that I know I had. I really do. And a lot of times I feel like I didn't, but I really do, because only I know what I really went through. You know, I can sit and talk to a psychiatrist or therapist, and they can help me to get in touch with some things that I experienced. But even when it's almost like I'm sitting in that chair, and I'm also sitting in this chair looking at myself, you know, because some of those things that I went through and stuff, they just don't even seem real. You know, it's sometimes they're hard for me to relate to. But then when my subconscious releases them, it kind of blows my mind of some of the stuff I did and some of the stuff I went through and survived.
When you look back, what have you learned about war as a result of your experience and your recovery?
That you can take an individual and you can train him, you can give him all of this. But when that person starts killing people, regardless if those people trying to kill him or her, you pay a psychological cost for that. I'm a firm believer when the Bible says, "Thou shalt not kill," it means that. Because when you take another human's life, you pay for that. You pay for that spiritually, emotionally, and particularly psychologically. You really do. You're going to have dreams, or you ain't going to be able to have real relationships. You pay for that. And all of these guys, you think about it. Back in World War II, they called post-traumatic stress disorder shell shock. Now, we all can relate to what shell shock was, particularly in its worst extreme. That was a person that might take his clothes off and get to running down the street, or that would do something real crazy. Now, when they came out with this post-traumatic stress disorder, I couldn't relate the two, you know, because I thought they were different. But the fact of the matter is they are the same. And if it wasn't for the Vietnam veteran, the guys that are going to Iraq and Afghanistan and all that would not have the things they have now. The VA would still not address the post-traumatic stress disorder that they know we all experience. Almost everybody go to the military and go through a combat situation, gonna come back with post-traumatic stress disorder. There ain't no training in the world that can prepare you for that. You know, you can go to, like I told you, we used to go attack this Vietnamese village, little Mark village, but they can't get you ready for when people are actually in that village and you going in there and now death, weapons, all that stuff is a part of that. They can't prepare you for that. You know, you can't. You just can't. You can't. You don't know how you. It's kind of like, you know, the flight response. Like you're arguing with somebody and your body tells you that I need to get away from this. And you feel like you need to run. But instead of running, you just hit the person before they hit you because you're afraid. You don't want to hit them, but you're afraid. And that's kind of like, you like that a lot, you know. You don't know what to do. You know, you're stuck in that. So you try to create an alternative existence. That's why alcohol and drugs come in. So you don't have to deal with all that stuff. You know, you don't have to be sitting there thinking about it all the time and this and that, you know. And then it's like, who the hell understands but a professional? You know, and even them, it's just like here in Champaign. They ain't many doctors you can go to that know anything about post-traumatic stress disorder.
You've had to go outside of
Champaign. Yeah, they just don't know. They never, like I say, the military, the way they did it for years and years and years, they act like it didn't exist. Because I always thought they didn't want to pay out all that money. You know, because they have an obligation to you to restore you back to wherever you was when you entered the service.
And how do you feel the military's done in your case?
I felt it was wrong. Even the doctors in Danville, when I went there back in, I think it was 2013, when I really started going back there, they were like, "Where you been? Why haven't you been here?" Because my first experience when I went to Danville, that psychiatrist and stuff that I talked to initially, he said, yeah, he suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder, but he got substance abuse problems. And that's all he wrote about.
You know, no care.
They just, they downplayed all of that, you know.
Did you think race had any factor in the way you were dealt with post,
you know? No, I really don't. I think it becomes economics. It's about money. It's about, because they have to pay out a lot of money. You know, they have to, and I think the VA now has got one of the biggest budgets they ever had, you know. And you think about it, Vietnam and say it was 10,000 or something that died there. It was a lot of people died in Vietnam. And I think that if you died in Vietnam, they paid your family. I forgot what it was, but it was hardly nothing, you know. So, of course, if you survived and then you came back, like you see these guys now with these titanium legs, and that stuff is real expensive. You know, back during the day, the VA would give you that old porcelain stuff, whatever it was. It was through, the Vietnam veteran constantly lobbying Congress and senators. And then, lo and behold, we started getting some senators and congressmen that had actually been in combat. And so they became sympathetic to us, and a lot of that stuff changed. You know, but it took a long time. Most Vietnam veterans never experienced it. They never experienced getting any help, you know.
You said before you left for Vietnam, you were already a hero, and then when you came back, you didn't wear your uniform. Do you feel like a hero, or how do you think about your service now, 50-some years later?
I think it was, don't nobody give a damn. It's not, the guys in the studio, they young. I bet you they never ask nobody, hey, tell me about your war experience. Why was that? They don't talk about that. It's just not interesting. It's not, you know, we done seen enough stuff on TV and stuff about wars and so forth. Then not only that, we in such a technical age that you turn on the TV, hell, I mean, you right there. You know, and here's guys that's, you know, in Afghanistan or whatever. And you see them all hunkered down there in the hills and all of that. And you look at that and you think that, oh, well, that's cool. That's par for the course. But you're not thinking about how that person had to climb up them hills and how his legs is probably all tore up from them rocks and stuff, from crawling on them and stuff. You're not thinking about this man ain't probably had a hot meal, and I don't know when. And you're not thinking about the fact that in his mind, he probably think he ain't gonna never come off that mountain. The only people that relate to that, I think, is veterans. Normal people in society, they don't think about all of that. When people say this all the time, they say, well, we got to thank the veterans because we wouldn't have the freedoms we had if it wasn't for the veterans. They don't know what that means. They don't really even relate to that. They just say that. You know, we know a lot about that because another thing, when you travel and the military expose you to different places in the world, you realize that, yeah, this is the best country going, you know? But you understand that. But a person that hasn't, how could you? What are you comparing it with? You see what I'm saying? You never seen real poverty, you know? We see poverty in this country, and we say, oh, man, they ain't got nothing. I've seen poverty where a person's whole house was made out of cans. Well, he took the cans and cut them open and spread them out, and they made them a wall and all of that. And they've been living in that house their whole life or whatever. And when it becomes damaged, they get some more cans and they repair it. And that's the way of life. You know, now that's some poverty.
What is your reason for talking and sharing your story? Why do you want to do that?
Because I would hope that other veterans, particularly been in combat, would automatically, part of their coming back to this country, go to the VA, get yourself checked out, because 9 times out of 10, you got some psychological problems. You may not want to deal with them, but I guarantee you they're there. If you're wondering why you don't really have friends and everybody else you know do, that's one of the reasons. You wonder why you can't have no meaningful relationships. That's another one. You wonder why you drinking all the time or you using drugs all the time. That's another one, you know. And you wonder why you do things that you can't explain or why you doing them. God knows we know right from wrong, but you still do them. You know, go to the VA and get yourself checked out. I guarantee you. You got problems. You really do. We're not designed to go into combat. Man been fighting since the world started, as far as I know. But as human beings, we're not designed for that. If I hurt you, I pay for that. You know, I think that's a spiritual law that's in effect. You know, we see people and we call them psychopaths. When a person can hurt you and have no conscience about it, we say he's a psychopath or she. Am I right? Yeah. Now, you tell me I can go to another country, kill these people and stuff like that, but I don't take on none of the psychopathic traits? Of course I do.
Is there anything else you'd like to share?
No, that's about it. I just want fellow veterans, you know, like I say, if you've been in a combat situation, go get yourself checked out. It's not a natural thing. It's not natural at all. When the Bible says, thou shalt not kill, it means that.
It does sound like to me, talking with you, that you've learned a lot about humanity through your experience with the war.
Yeah, but it took a long time. It took a long time. It did. I've been in counseling sessions where I remember stuff that I had never remembered for the last 40-some years, and it just popped in my head. That's why I know that we need that. We need to release all of that stuff we got inside of us, that because it comes out in a lot of ways that's destructive. And destructive not only to yourself, but your fellow mankind, you know. Look at these veterans getting on top of buildings and shooting police and stuff. You know, come on now. You know, that's a person that probably if they had some intervention with the VA and stuff and got some help, that probably wouldn't have never happened. But what do you do with all of that? You know, what you do with all that? They just... I mean, you know, you just, once you enter the military and you go in a combat situation, you're going to deal with that the rest of your life. It ain't no taking off the uniform and that's it. It just don't work like that. It just don't. And another thing that kind of blows your mind is like my grandkids and stuff, they are so disinterested in all. I bet you not one of my grandkids could they tell you I've been in the service and what I did.
Because you haven't told them or they haven't asked?
They ain't interested.
Maybe they will one day.
No, maybe so. If I've tried to make efforts or whatever to tell them different, they just not interested. Hmm. Young people today ain't interested in hearing all about all that stuff. Hmm. No, most young people find news depressing. They don't watch it. Mm-hmm. People like us that watch the news a lot because we
read the paper.
Right, because we caught up in what's going on. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, because we realize that we have an obligation. We have to be responsible and check out all of that, because I might be driving down the street and see something or whatever. Mm-hmm. But a lot of young people today care less.
Thank you, Mr. Hyde.
You're welcome. Thank you.